And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I am now here with a favorite on Millennial each year, certainly one of my favorites, the Distributist. I don't think he needs any introduction. So, unless you want to say, how are you doing, Dave?
I will say thank you for allowing me to swap my spot with my friend Luth Templar, because I was traveling for business and delayed, and it was a really great save. So thank you very much for that.
That's okay. There have been a few cancellations. I think three cancellations this year. The rest have just had to be rescheduled. So yeah, it happens. So anyway, it doesn't matter. As we were saying before we went on air, I think this has been a very interesting year.
Yeah,
and I think there are all sorts of things that I've written about it through the year on Substack, and you as well. And of course, you've also done live streams. I was saying I loved your live stream right after the Charlie Kirk killing. I thought that was a very touching and heartfelt and intellectually fascinating live stream. I can't remember what it was called, but everyone should go and look at that. But Charlie Kirk's killing is obviously a key event this year. But I think in general, even before that happened, and I mean, it's changed the dynamic, but in general, we just seem to be living in a time of transition and emerging chaos. And I think that incident did add to that in a way. There's now a sort of uncertainty about the future of Turning Point. But that's all. I don't want to get sidelined into that, because I think the
conservative civil war. Yeah, the conservative civil war is almost the least interesting thing to happen after Charlie's death. It's kind of petty and pathetic and low class. Whereas the moment of Charlie Kirk's death was a moment of kind of supreme clarity, this conservative civil war, the more you look into it, the stupider you get, right? Like, it's like getting
exactly
drunk, right.
Lowbrow power dynamics.
Yeah, whereas there's Charlie not much Kirk, there. Charlie Kirk's death was an awakening, and you know, I wasn't planning to talk about this, but it actually really leads into it properly. You know, Charlie Kirk's death, well, first of all, it's inseparable, even though it was separated by almost a month, from the death of Irina Zarudska. And the reason, there are a few things that happened. First of all, Irina Zarudska was something that happens all the time in the United States. There is kind of this, how should I put this? There's an underclass in America of people who are suffering from mental disabilities that the justice system refuses to put away, and that are a danger to themselves and others. This underclass is disproportionately minority, and many of them are fomenting racial grievances. That sounds like there's a group of them, but this is just a perennial problem in American cities. It frequently gets people killed or heavily injured. Every year, there are multiple cases like this. But for some reason, the Irina Zarudska thing was different in that this became national news. And I think that the thing that made it kind of interesting and special was, first of all, Irina Zarudska was an immigrant, a refugee from Europe, and from a battle that Europeans really care about. And Americans are, I think, a lot of European right-wingers are much more invested in the outcome of the Ukraine war, which they should be. Many more American right-wingers are just want the war to end. And I'm not going to get into that, but this was a supreme object of sympathy for both the right-wingers on the European side and on the American side. And she encounters this violence, and the reason why she encounters this violence is she's not aware of it. She walks onto a public transit system in a city that's highly minority, and she's not on guard. And it demonstrates exactly, you know, it demonstrates A, why Americans oftentimes do not like using public transit because it's not safe. And it inverted kind of the victim dynamic, and it created this moment of clarity about the reality of crime in America. And there was a sense among white America, and I think even Europeans at the same time, that this was a crime that couldn't be allowed to fade into just the statistic, the disproportionate FBI crime statistics. And this had to be actually addressed as the fundamental product of American justice, and increasingly European justice, if you look at places like some areas of England and Sweden. And what was so funny is that Charlie Kirk, although he had gotten the reputation 5 years ago as being kind of this establishmentarian conservative, he was pushing. Like, I was following his Twitter account because he was one of the people who was pushing for Irina Zaritska's name to be immortalized as a victim of leftist malfeasance. And then the very next day, he's taken out on camera himself. And, you know, this is what he did. There is a great Substacker, John Carter. They stabbed Peace in the throat, and then they shot Dialogue in the head or something like that. Or, well, I guess they both got wounded in the throat. So, but either way, it's this message that, you know, okay, the reality of our situation is kind of plainly in front of us right now. And what country do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a country where you're afraid of the public square, where you are, I mean, this is also underlined in Irina Zaritska's death, is that the number of deaths per 1,000 in Ukraine of civilians is lower than that of inner city Baltimore. So by being a refugee, they sent her to a place that was less safe than the war zone that she fled. And, you know, and
fucking hell.
I know the question, and people didn't know, it's amazing, right? But your cities, do you want your cities to be turned into war zones? Do you want your daughters to be afraid? I mean, you can insulate yourself from this, right? You can become atomized. You can withdraw into your shell, and that will definitely protect you physically. And, you know, a lot of the decrease in crime in America over the last 30 years has been just that. It's been people engaging less socially in the world and therefore being more safe, but at the same time being more disconnected. And, you know, the same thing's true for Charlie Kirk. Okay, you know, your role as a conservative is just to complain online. And the second you try to voice your opinions about anything or bring dialogue to people in real life, you're killed. And not only that, the left celebrates your death. And this is something that is, I mean, you know, this was the left's war up and down. It didn't do that. It was obviously excusing Charlie Kirk's death in a variety of different ways, even at the elite levels. And the message that was sort of sent out was, I mean, it was a confirmation of a mode that we all kind of had felt, that discourse was dying. You know, this is what the 10th millennial?
The 11th.
11th, okay. Interesting. I thought it was started in 2015, but I was just a latecomer.
No, it did. It did. So that means that this is the 11th one.
Oh, okay. My numeracy is showing. But thank you, Woz. Pardon me. But you know, early on, and this is something that I know a lot of other people brought up. I think Black Horse, my friend Black Horse, brought this up. Millennial is this excellent record of the perspectives people were taking to varieties of problems across the last decade. And the big thing about the you can see is that early on in millennial, people are more jokey and they're less serious. But there is this belief that grievances once voiced are going to have some kind of purchase in the public square, that there is some kind of discourse that we're participating in. And in a sense, it is true, you know, by presenting our ideas in public, there is kind of an implicit dialectic that is going on just in terms of how people choose their sides of the culture war. But there's not some kind of conversation that goes on the way you might imagine a public debate inside a society going. It's basically two people staring at each other across a trench and trying to size each other up or trying to figure out what side they should be on ultimately. And I think that this is, I mean, I could keep on going about this, but this is the big thing that came out of 2024. And this is the big thing that we're dealing with right now as we are looking at a completely post-discourse or a post-traditional discourse age.
Yeah. I think another part of it is that at least until, well, it's the role of power in that. So you've got the left, like some SJW, you've got on the right, someone like me, whatever. But then power is a presence. And for a very long time, the SJW absolutely, totally had power on her side and completely poised against me. Or the person that, yeah, the right winger. That has become a bit more muddy recently. And I know that the left are convinced. I mean, they were always convinced that they were the underdogs, but now they're even more convinced that Trump is a fascist dictator and J.D. Vance and Elon Musk and Nick Fuentes and Alex Jones. And they're all actually in charge. And it's, you know, it's corporations are funding us, you and me, and Kremlin is funding you and me, and you know, so forth. That's what they believe. And basically, the left now are utterly convinced that the powerful are right wing and you know, Christian, conservative, racist, homophobic, all of that.
We're under a secret Christian nationalist government. You know, that's the
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I saw that horrible Paul Thomas Anderson movie, One Battle After the Other. It was almost so bad it was good, but it was like looking into a progressive's mind. It was wild, you know. And, yeah. and I like his other stuff.
Is it like I just described?
Yeah. The United States is ruled by a secret cabal of white supremacists who assassinate political leaders for having out of wedlock interracial children. To which, when I saw that, I turned to my wife and I said, I wonder if J.D. Vance is invited to these meetings. but, you know.
there's a blatant contradiction right there, but that won't stop them. They won't.
No.
Right there. Yeah.
Pardon me, go ahead.
Yeah, that's the story that they tell themselves. But leaving aside that and their stupidity, I just wanted to bring in generally this fact that, yes, it's been a discourse, as you said, and there's the left and the right, but then there's always this jockeying and trying to second guess, well, what do the powerful think? And for a very long time, it was straightforward. It was very simple. The powerful are on the left side. They're on the SJW side. Or at least, and I think now it looks more like they were never actually on the left side. They were just using the left. The left were galvanized, financed, pumped full of money and resources just to really wreck society with wokery. And for whatever reason, that now seems to be stepped back from by the powerful to some extent. Of course, that's a big debate in itself. To what extent are they actually putting the woke away? And to what extent are they just turning the volume down a bit? Will it be restored in a few years' time? But either way, I just wanted to mention that it's what we realized is, yes, there's discourse, and yes, there's debate, there's the exchange of ideas, but really it happens in silos. And we are not actually that interested. I mean, we might be mildly curious about what, you know, some leftist perspective on something, just to hear, like, in the same way we'd be curious about a Martian's perspective on something.
I find leftists online really interesting, but you have to kind of understand what you're seeing, right? I mean, when you watch like modern millennial leftists, you're watching an entertainment product. And when we talk about people like the establishment leftists, you're talking about a political coalition. Now the problem is that at some point, the narrative that was fed to millennial leftists, I mean, actually, this has been happening for 3 decades, but it really came into focus in the last 5 years. It stopped being able to interface with the reality of the world that we live in. So none of their reads on any contemporary events make any sense. I mean, you did an article on this. I did an article on this. To look at a modern dyed-in-the-wool progressive is to look at a person who's struggling to fit his worldview into a problem that the language he's using makes absolutely no sense to confront. And, you know, there's a British version of this, and there is an American version of this. I mean, like, immigration's a great example, like its impact on labor, the relations with the demographic changes and who's ultimately going to benefit from that. The fact that white leftists just generally are occupying a smaller and smaller segment of their own societies. So when you look at someone like Zora Mamdani, you know, there's all these boomer takes on Zora Mamdani. This is the new mayor of New York City. You know, Zora Mamdani is not really a Muslim. I don't think he's devout at all. And he's not really a communist in the sense that he is some kind of dyed-in-the-wool Marxist. He's an opportunist. He's here to sell himself as a product and then to push forward his coalition of people, which are largely his own racial and religious cohort, which I guess in that sense he's a Muslim, in that he will advance Muslim people's interests at the expense of the more heritage stock in New York City, which is ironically enough, you know, largely Italian and Jewish. And you know, that is what Zora Mamdani represents. Nothing really religious or ideological. And there's no way you can process that reality as a leftist. You have to imagine that Zora Mamdani is, you know, the genuine article. And you know, it's just obvious to me at least that he's not.
Of course, this is all about the endless salience of ethnicity. And really, he's just there to get more people like himself into power.
Yeah,
and that's what he'll do. No matter how he gets, and all the other stuff. I mean, I would
which
say
is real.
Exactly the same.
That's real. That, like, Zora Mamdani is playing a real political game. His white supporters are just play acting a fantasy.
Yeah, I would say the same about Hamza Yousaf in Scotland, of all places, if you were to go from New York to Scotland.
Very similar characters.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he really cares that much. I mean, I don't think he really cares that much about, for example, trans rights or gay marriage or whatever. I think what he cares about is, and this comes through in that famous speech of his, what he cares about is that there are not many people who look like him in Scotland, and that's annoying. That's deeply, profoundly annoying to him. And he wants to change that, regardless of whatever he has to demolish in order to achieve that. You know, whole ethnicities, heritage, national cultures, legal systems, whatever, as long as there are more people, many more people like him in that place. And this is all to do with the primacy of genes, frankly. I'm sorry to put it in such crass language.
Yeah, I mean, it's genes and religion. I think these things are highly, you know, related. You know, there is kind of, I mean, you know, I can't remember, one of your previous guests a long time ago said that, you know, certain people's kind of carry religious perspectives with them, right? So there is there's a broadly Christian perspective that it seems to accompany even atheist Europeans. And there is a broadly Islamic perspective that accompanies many people from Pakistan. And even though they may themselves not be really believers, this is, you know, it's at this level where I don't think it's almost beside the point to kind of focus on where this begins and ends, because it's so obvious what's going on, right? Like, in broad strokes, it's obvious that what's going on is a hard power grab. And this gets to your famous tweet of the year, right? Like, you'd have to either be so ideologically drunk or stupid that you can't see it, or so cynical that you just won't see it. And you can look at people in, like, especially libertarians and the Cato people in America are particularly bad at this. Some of the regime evangelical neocons are really bad at this. They'll do anything to stop seeing what, to not see what's actually going on in these situations, because they don't have language to describe it. Now, whereas the right wing, you know, basically there's a division between the people who can see what's going on, the people who want to maintain the language of the post-World War II consensus. In the left, there are people who know what's going on, but they can't say it. And so the left it still has all the institutions, it still has all the power, other than, you know, some departments of the federal government on the executive branch in America. It has total hegemonic control. But whenever progressives speak as progressives, they cannot directly interface with the reality that is going on in front of their eyes. They always have to talk around it. And because of that, progressivism becomes this kind of useless cultural marker. And, you know, it's useless to dialogue with it, because as your tweet said, right, when they speak as progressives, they have to pretend they can't see the racial stuff. They have to pretend they can't see the religious stuff. They have to pretend they can't see the drug stuff or the stuff having to do with birth rates or marriage or relationships between men and women generally. All this stuff they have to pretend not to see in order to be progressives in good standing. So I mean, what are you going to talk about? You're basically just flexing at that stage.
Yeah. And another one, a very sort of gross example is, they have to pretend to not see the problem with a male guy, like a guy, breastfeeding a baby.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's the one I go to because it's the most viscerally, it's obviously wrong and perverse. Whatever is coming out of his nipple, it's not milk, and we all fucking know it. I mean, of course it isn't. How could it be? So you are advocating poisoning a baby with God knows what chemicals, because it'll be all hormones, isn't it? Weird chemicals and whatever. You're advocating poisoning a baby in order to maintain your worldview. So when a right winger tries to talk to a leftist about that, they simply have to misunderstand the questions and the points that are made. So what is a man? What is a nipple? What is a chemical? What's a hormone? I don't know what you mean. What's a baby? What are you talking about?
Well, and this is kind of what, you know, what happened this year. This is something that's kind of interesting that happened in 2025. There is very much a difference between the progressive true believers and the managerial class, even though they both present themselves as having the same core ideology. The managerial class wants to sweep woke progressivism under the rug for the time being. They can't do it indefinitely, because if they do it indefinitely, their coalition breaks. But they're coming clean about things, right? Like the New York Times came clean about the lab leak origin story in spring. And then they started coming clean about a lot of the grooming gang stuff. They've been trying to come clean about crime statistics in America. And, you know, most recently, and this was something that was kind of forced on them by Jacob Savage in this article we could debate over. It's not a very original article, but it was a very effective one. You probably missed this because you were doing millennial, but there is a seminal article that came out in Compact documenting the extent of anti-white, anti-male discrimination going on in elite institutions in America, and how basically an entire generation of young men was just locked out of positions they had been trained for.
And I skimmed the article. It was extremely... it was very long, but
it was great. You know, we could argue. I'm writing an article about why it broke through. The article had been written 1,000 times before across the last 10 years. It's been incredibly obvious, but that article was part of a general effort of like these establishment types, like Ezra Klein and Noah Smith, to kind of come clean about their role. And they're like, oh, well, we were always against this going too far. You know, we always knew this was happening. Like, then they can't pretend like, Well, I guess we went a little bit too far back then. Like, it's already over. They talk about it like you're doing some kind of postmortem. Well, there's something we can do about it now. We have to move forward. And, the problem is that it is very, I think they do this with, to come up with a, for your UK viewers. I've noticed this among the British commentariat too. They talk about the Boris wave, like mass demographic changing mass migration was something that happened during like the previous administration. We're all talking about this in the past as if it's not currently going on.
Right? Like, same, it's even more so the case with the grooming gangs where they talk about it as if that stopped, and it hasn't. There's no evidence that it stopped.
No, it's still going on, right? No. It might even have increased for all we know. But they talk about it like we're doing a post-mortem. Like we're dredging up ancient history. We're trying to make political hay on something. Because the reason why is that they need to admit to this in order to sell themselves as experts to the people who are their constituencies. The people who are constituencies know that male breast milk isn't real milk. They know that men who are weigh 250 pounds can't compete against women in rugby. You know, they know that mass migration is happening, and they're starting to see that young white men are basically getting locked out of professions. They can see all this stuff. And so to preserve themselves as viable people in power, they have to admit to it, but they have to admit to it in a way that doesn't imply they can do anything about it, because they can't. Because the minute they fix any of these problems, their coalition will break. And this is what makes the power structure in America and, well, you know, really all of the West so highly unstable. All realities that pertain to solutions are outside what the elite considers to be the Overton window. And as such, you could only have honest conversations by essentially having conversations that the mainstream media considers unacceptable.
Yeah. And I think also, this is something that was brought up last night, that this might be now emulated by on the mainstream right, where, okay, we'll talk about some issues, but we'll talk about them in a way that doesn't break the, as you say, the frame, the leftist frame.
Yeah. I mean, so this, for example, you can see this. Yeah, go on.
J.D. Vance said in a speech at Turning Points that you don't have to apologize for being white anymore in America. Mm. But then he said, and if you're Asian, you don't have to lie about that or work around that when you're applying for an academic position. Now, I think that he was referring to Northeast, like Japanese, the ones who are high IQ who get... but either way, the crowd, the audience cheered for the first thing, and then they cheered for the second thing as well, as if that's what Turning Point is. Well, I mean, Charlie Kirk was not talking about this kind of thing towards the end of his life. He was talking about Irina Zarutska.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and this is, you know, I'm going to skip ahead here. I mean, this kind of... the conservatives, again, the conservative civil war in America going on right now is incredibly petty. We're basically exactly the same place we were in like literally last Christmas. Right?
Yeah.
Just
before you go to that, because we don't need to talk about that, because I don't think there's much in it. But the point I was making there is I can see the right, the mainstream right, now doing the same thing the left does, because none of them want to shatter the frame, because then people like us would be consulted, let's say. We would become relevant. So what they want is to maintain the post-war consensus. And in the case of J.D. Vance, that is, race simply doesn't matter. Nobody should care about it. Mm. It's just skin color, and everyone should be just as an individual. Well, that's what people were saying in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's what they were saying in the 2000s, really. It only changed about 2015, really. It was Trayvon Martin and all that that started.
Well, I mean, really, J.D. Vance has been doing a But for all the fact that he's kind of still within the post-war consensus, he is doing a pretty good job, in my opinion, about talking about this. I go back and forth on the man myself, but really the symbol of the pushback on this in the Republican side is less J.D. Vance and more Vivek Ramaswamy, who's pushing. He both this Christmas and last Christmas, he pushed this issue to the fore in the exact way that kind of made it cut the most. I don't exactly know what his angle is. I see him as someone that's very similar to, really the other two South Asian politicians we discussed in this stream so far, but just kind of a power grabber. But he essentially has for the last year been putting forward this concept of what it means to be an American is just to believe the Constitution, work really hard, and I don't know, that was pretty much it, pass the citizenship test. I'm working through the citizenship test with my wife right now. This is like really easy stuff. it's the point where she's never been an American. She's Canadian, right? It's kind of, she's never been an American. And I even kind of give her a bad time if she gets one of the 100 questions wrong. This is easy stuff. I mean, this is absolute hogwash. It's almost a gift to the right. I mean, I was going to say, it's not exactly the same thing as on the left, because the problem with the right is the establishment right side of the argument doesn't have a politically active constituency. what Vivek, I was thinking, okay, why is Vivek doing this stuff? Why is he calling Americans lazy? Why is he saying that any one person on earth who believes in the Constitution and who works hard is just as American, if not more American than you, when your family's been here for 200 years and mine has not, certainly. Why is he saying all this demonstrably idiotic shit and pissing off the constituency, the politically active constituency of the Republican Party? Well, it's because he's not selling to them. He's selling to boomers. And Vivek is, this, I'm kind of copying this from Kevin Dolan, but Vivek is he's buying what the boomers want to sell. The boomers want to sell the inheritance of the West for a comfortable decade, on through the 2030s. And Vivek and the rest of the aspiring third world wants to buy in. And that's the deal that they want to make. Now, the boomers do not want to have a discussion about what it means to be an American, because everybody knows what it means to be. I mean, again, I hate kind of borrowing the leftist terminology. It is kind of a spectrum about what it means to be an American. There are gray edges. Obviously I am not a heritage American, but we all know what it means to be an American. And if we realize and actually describe what it means to be an Englishman, what it means to be a Frenchman, what it means to be German, then immediately the people, the boomers who are in charge of the government, have to come to terms with exactly what was lost, what exactly the last 20 or 30 years have meant for these countries. And that is exactly the political reality they do not want to come face to face with.
Oh, yeah. This is the whole civic nationalist thing that has defined the boomers' lives and really was threatened by 9/11. But they got over that. And, that could have been a waking up moment, but no, it wasn't. Swept under the rug.
Well, that's interesting with the whole Bondi Beach thing, too, right? This came right after the whole Piers Morgan tikka masala thing. And he wakes up the next day and goes like, what's going on at Bondi Beach? And everyone's replying, it's your bill for the most expensive tikka masala of all time, Piers. It's sad because, and the thing is with 9/11, this whole counter jihad thing that America, the America way of conceptualizing 9/11 was, the world is still moving towards perfect multiculturalism. There's just a problem, and that problem's name is Islam. And it's not all Muslims. It's just a particular kind of Muslims who really, 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 really believe in this, you know, radical ideology of Salafism, right? Which is, none of that is true, really. I mean, again, I'm not saying that Islam is not a highly aggressive religion. It is. I'm not saying that people who follow the Salafist ideas in these organizations like ISIS aren't dangerous. They are. The problem is that all of those, that everything about that perspective looks at it the wrong way. Most people on this earth see their political interest as extending directly from their ethnic and religious group. Now, they do not necessarily need to be radical or bound up in some kind of fanatical ideology to think that way. And furthermore, when they build communities amongst themselves, they will naturally spawn radicals who will take things to a higher level inside those political dynamics. And furthermore, even beyond that, they will engage in a certain low-level amount of aggression and dispossession of the native population just because they're operating inside those group conflict dynamics. A great example is like the grooming gangs. I doubt that there were many devout Muslims in the grooming gangs. They were all Muslims. And there were some white people who were there too, but almost all of them were Muslims in the broad sense. But I doubt very many of them were studying the Quran.
No. And the thing is, it doesn't actually make any difference to us whether they were or not. But I take the point that the boomer, the safe Sivnat defense or a treatment of the grooming gangs would be, well, their religion made them do it. And I guess this is what Tommy Robinson is hoping people will believe. But it's nonsense. I don't believe, and you can find scripture from the Quran that says this stuff, but well, I just don't believe that that's the reason. And
then you realize the people who do this stuff are like illiterate, right?
Yeah.
Like they never learned a single word in any language in their entire lives, right? There's no way these ideas could influence them. Or they have functionally so low IQs they couldn't even understand the concept that there was a prophet, you know, 1400 years ago that was saying these things. This is totally an emergent property of the group dynamic itself. And furthermore, I mean, more than just having to deal with people who are bombing, you know, Christmas festivals or raping little girls. I'd hate to put it this way, but the larger sort of generational problem is that they're going to be the authorities in, I don't know, a handful of decades in a lot of areas around the West. And in that case, you are going to have to deal with them as the majority in a lot of areas, if not in your entire nation. And that's something that boomer mind just cannot comprehend it. And this is the problem there is like, there is no, the people who are the civic nationalists, 10 years ago when the millennials started, there were actual civic nationalist believers that were sincere. One of them was named Sargon of Akkad. That was a legitimate possible position you could be in. Like, it didn't make sense if you kind of perturbed it a little bit and tried to figure out what they got wrong in their assumptions. But the idea that the problem was just these outliers and that the solution was education and assimilation. Well, it is very obvious at this stage for the last 5 years that these new immigrants aren't assimilating. And they won't assimilate at some future point either, because as time goes on, the percentage of the native population goes down, making assimilation less possible and less likely. People assimilate when they feel that the powerful peer group has a certain culture. They assimilate to the powerful. How are you going to assimilate these immigrants into white culture when you've been excluding all of the white men from attaining positions of power as outlined by that Jacob Savage article? It's impossible. I mean, this is not something that can be there's no credible way to believe this. So when you talk to somebody, you know, on the American side, like Joel Berry or Seth Dillon, or I never talked to James Lindsay, but I imagine he said they end up laying out these kind of horribly idealistic just so stories where where America is way more Christian than it actually is, where all we have to do is slow down the immigration rate and then sanity is restored. In America right now, they sell this as the fact that Trump permanently killed wokeness. Well, you know, Trump might have killed wokeness if you define wokeness as white leftism. Now, when I said how progressivism died, we both wrote how progressivism died articles around the same time. But it is very clear that 20th century white leftism of the intellectual variety is dying or dead. But I want to grab as much power as possible as a new immigrant to your country. That is very much alive and well, and that is one of the most powerful political forces in the West right now, in both America and in Europe.
Yeah, and I think that the left is going to become just completely ethnic, really. The white liberals are going to just find that they're not welcome anymore. There's no need for them there. There's no use for them.
So let's say you're a white working class guy and you want to talk about limiting immigration or any of the concerns of labor. If you move into a leftist space as a white man, they will try to keep you out because in your strong will, you're not just a pushover. They will try to keep you out because they're fighting for turf inside the leftist coalition. So if you want to have a conversation about class where you have equal standing, you cannot be entertained in ordinary leftist circles, either of the managerial variety or of the ideologically pure woke variety. They will keep you out of those spaces. So even if you hold socialist opinions, the only way you can discuss that is in a right-leaning or even radical right forum.
Yeah. And then you've also got the more awful middle-class leftist, the blue-haired SJW type, the 20-year-old girl who knows nothing. Well, I can imagine that she would get a fairly warm reception in a room full of brown and black men, but it wouldn't be the kind of reception that she wants. I mean, enough said.
Yeah.
She's not going to be taken seriously as a thinker, let's put it that way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, unfortunately, the female side of the equation is a difficult one because women will... The establishment knows that the base of its ability to hold on to power in the West relies on young women in particular voting for them. And their organizations will respond to that by trying to elevate white women in terms of power, at least initially. And of course, if you're also elevating non-white men, you'll get very little pushback from the new immigrants, regardless of how socially conservative they are otherwise, or regardless of how many positions these white women might seem like they're taking from their co-ethnics, because it plays into their broader plan. This is just, you can't run political coalitions on the left without having white women on board. And this is one of the real challenges that remains for the right. The gender war, the war between the sexes, is not some politically neutral war. When men and women fight, the left benefits. All gender conflicts benefit the left, always. They will always lead to disorder. They will always make family formation more difficult. And they will always make any kind of right-wing thinking, properly speaking, more difficult. Now, I don't know if that means we should disengage, but you know, all I'm saying is that there are almost no shitlibs in South Africa anymore. There are still young shitlib white women in South Africa. It's hard to believe, but there are.
Yeah. I've encountered some on Twitter. Yeah, it's astonishing because I mean, but maybe we get a certain biased impression of South Africa. I don't know. So somehow they are able to maintain their insane beliefs in amongst all of this crap that's going on, this anti-white mania that's going on over there.
Well, they're individually elevated, though. The organizations of the government realize that. I mean, look, I don't think it's even a majority of white South African women who are young, but if you can hold as part of your revolutionary coalition a sizable subset of your direct opponents, women. I mean, you kind of literally have them by the balls. You know, that is no coalition can say, if you're playing hard politics, you can't say no to that. And so the question is, like, how can you imagine a political movement that gets men and women to operate on the same side? And it's very difficult to think in that direction.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Because the right is vastly male. Even, like, I remember my channel was hardly the most butch channel on the right. But even that was only 7% female. You know, it just didn't get, I mean, I a very tiny number of female subscribers. And that's normal. That's normal for our guys. I mean, the right simply doesn't appeal to women, at least not in a time of comfort and plenty.
No.
I think that's the issue. And I'm sorry, I keep coming back to this, that nothing, like, to an extent, nothing is going to change while there is still luxury, while we're still the clean water coming out of the tap, the electricity is on, the Wi-Fi works, and there's plenty of food. And everything. Then the more fanciful among us, and that means the young white women, are just going to be able to keep believing whatever the hell they like.
Well, so I mean, look. You know, there's a limit to this, right? I'm going to make an optimistic prediction, which is very much unlike me. I think that the divergence between male and female opinion is going to start tapping out. I think that it's diverged, as at least if you control for ethnicity, race, and religion. I think that the divergence will start tapping out this year or next year, and men and women will start coming back together again. And I and this is not going to be across the board, right? There are still going to be sizable parts of young women who are just eternally dedicated to hard progressive causes. But what's really going to cut into this perspective is that I think that, I don't know, have you looked at many progressive women in our age cohort, aka older millennials? They look terrible. They look absolutely terrible. Nobody wants to live that kind of, and it's not just, I'm not just talking about influencers. I'm talking about just across the board, the people who are in those radical positions are just not very enviable. And I think that if the right can kind of conceptualize itself, and, you know, there's not going to just be one right. This is another misnomer. There is kind of one left. There is kind of one properly white Western left that was politically born from the Enlightenment, and that was put into power everywhere by the end of World War II by FDR's State Department. There is one left in that sense, and it's got a radical side and a not radical side. The same is not true for the right. There will be multiple right-wing groups, aka there'll be multiple groups that are pursuing life in politics in a more traditional mode. And I just think that these groups are going to start getting better. Well, it's our job to make sure that these groups start getting better results for people than their radical alternatives on the left. And I think that will really start, you know, causing a lot of corrosion and a lot of second thinking from people who would ordinarily be the target demographics for progressivism. If that has not already happened, I should say. Like I said, this is already happening in 2025. I think this is the year we first saw that start.
And why do you think that has started? Because I'm thinking of that guy, the progressive guy who got just killed by a black guy, and his girlfriend was with him. You must have seen the footage at the time. It must have been about 2 years ago now.
Yeah, I wrote an article. I remember.
Yeah, it was awful. It was so awful.
And then his girlfriend was out a few months ago being one of the big campaigners for Zohran Mamdani.
My God.
Everywhere, campaigning for Zohran Mamdani. who is essentially the light on crime candidate, right? This is, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, this has not happened yet, but they're starting to become a mode in which it is it's not cool to be right wing. I mean, look, if you're cool and you're right wing, then you're cool. I'm not cool. But if you're cool and you're right wing, then you're cool. But there's something implicitly cool about being right wing. But starting in 2024, really, and really kicking in 2025, there's something really, really, really uncool about being a left winger. And, you know, I know you said you don't, you study leftist content like they're space aliens. It was for this reason that I was looking into just the history of BreadTube. These people are just these. I mean, again, you know, I don't think that I'm particularly cool. I'm kind of an old man who has his opinions and his writings or whatever. I'm a millennial, so I'm not that old. But still, you know, I'm not young either. But bred to, they make anyone just look, you know, they make anyone else just look like a rock star in comparison. You know, just it's hard to really take stock of that. And that is reflected everywhere. No one looks at, I don't remember this woman's name who was the girlfriend of that stabbing victim back in 2023. But no one looks at that and thinks, wow, I really want to be like her. You know, even if they're a New York hipster, you'd much rather be Dasha or Anna from the Red Scare, which, you know, probably by our standards aren't right wing, but for New York City standards are far right wingers.
I'm trying to find out what her name is because I haven't seen this. And I can't remember the guy's name. Oh, Ryan Carson. Was that it? That might have been
it. I have a Substack on it. Like, wait, but this was 2 years ago at least.
Yeah, it was October 23. I can't believe it's so long ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Right. Okay. I'll try to find his girlfriend and see what she's doing because it's amazing. Okay, Claudia Morales.
Yeah, that was her. That's her. Yeah, and she was a big
Go on.
I hope I'm not putting this woman's memory down, but she was a big supporter of Mondani. You know, that was if memory serves me correctly. I think this is her on X, but I mean, maybe I should check this real time. But I have a tweet by her right now, you know, where she's defending Zora Mamdani, and this has been her thing for a while. So, you know, again, maybe I have a Google doppelganger, you know, or a Twitter doppelganger, but I don't think I do. I think this is a pattern, though, of millennial leftists, basically. I don't think that what you're interacting with is not something they pursue leftism in a way that's not like what we're doing with our right-wing ideas. What we're doing with our right-wing ideas is we have an objection to a certain way of thought. They are following left-wing ideas like a certain kind of identity or almost like a fashion. It's very strange. It's almost religious, but it's a religion that is in a particular stage where the religion is doesn't really care about people believing it anymore. It just cares about people presenting as it.
Yeah, here's something. Two things I would say. It looks like she's not exactly white. I would say she looks you know, Latina or something. Yeah. But second, here she is cozying up to Mamdani.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't post the photos. It doesn't matter. But it reminds me of when one of the guys that Kyle Rittenhouse killed after the trial. The girlfriend of one of those guys said that she wanted to reach out and reconcile with Kyle Rittenhouse, and everyone said, "Okay, so even guys on the right who supported Rittenhouse were sort of baffled by this and saying, well, look, he killed your boyfriend. Why do you want to talk to him?" And there was definitely an element of flirtation about it. Mm-hmm. And people were sort of baffled. But, well, what is it? It's a woman cozying up to the winner. And I think it's the same thing here with Mom Danny and this stupid woman.
Yeah, I mean, I think that she would have supported Mom Donnie in any case because she was a progressive before her boyfriend got slapped and she's a progressive after. You know, so she might be a genuine religious fanatic. But I really think that, you know, women are absolute genius. I have to give credit to my, I'll mention this here. I had this catastrophe flying back where somebody stole my bag with a bunch of valuable things in it. It was an accidental stealing. It had the exact same marker on it. And while they he walked away with the bag, he walked all the way across the airport. And then, of course, by the time I got off the plane, I had this valuable bag. I was going to miss my flight. I might even miss the stream. And out of nowhere, my wife just picks up on a scent. By pure intuition, goes to a random gate and finds the guy who has my bag and just asks for it back, and she gets it back. It was like magic, right? And there's been a few times like that where women have an incredible intuition for strange things like that, strange interpersonal habits or serendipities and stuff like that. There is indeed a female genius. But there is a huge female blind spot when it comes to how politics works. They're a very unreliable demographic to rely on. They don't understand. They view politics as essentially as something like a contest of strength and popularity, not as a banner that you're rallying behind. And so a lot of times this means that female support is very easy to purchase. It is very hard to keep when times get rough. So a lot of the female support and advocacy will evaporate when it seems like it's not very fashionable or not a good look to be in that position. And look, there are deeply devout women who will stick with their guns, but women will always prefer people to ideologies. And so I this sounds horribly misogynistic, but when it comes to female political actors, I really have to understand what brings them to the position. And I don't usually trust ideology for when I always trust personal relationship.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think it's daddy issues or something.
It's very unusual for a woman raised in a Christian/European environment to feel immediate sexual attraction for the man who murdered someone she was previously attracted to. In our civilization, that has not been common for at least 1,000 years. It has been very common in almost all other civilizations, with the exception of, you know, ones like China or whatever, right? So, you know, that's a bad sign. That's a sign that the civilizational strength is waning on these regulations, because ordinarily women understand attraction to be much different than just the strongest person in the room.
Yeah. I think this is it's fascinating, but and there's a lot that could be said about it. And I think what I want to ask you about is what you said earlier, that as these things become more expensive, these luxury beliefs become unsustainable, people will naturally drift away from them. But why do you think that is going to happen? I mean, is it because the economy is heading for the doldrums, or the demographics, the diversity is going to corrode everyday life? What is it?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a combination of those three things. Economically, the white elite that can be supported in progressive institutions is going to start evaporating very quickly. Your ability to escape the negative consequences of diversity is also going to start evaporating. And because of that, you know, these beliefs become much more expensive to maintain. People are also kind of going to become exhausted of the shtick, so to speak. So I'll put it this way. I don't know how much I want to tell a story about this, but let's leave aside, you know, people are talking about various forms of exhaustion, when it comes to the behavior of certain groups in the West that might be if it's immigrant or, non-majority population that have disproportionate proclivities for some crimes. That's been a theme of this year.
You might say that they're endlessly criminal.
Okay. Yes. But to take a better example, not a better one, but one that's sort of more intimate to like my experience. I grew up in a very progressive area, and this was in the age of like when gay rights was really popular. And the person that was kind of like the front page person for this world was this guy called Dan Savage. And he and a bunch of other people had these really cute explanations of all of these gay behaviors that would otherwise be considered totally pathological and unacceptable. But they all had kind of cute explanations for why this was, and it was because we had a better system. No one believes this anymore. No one believes that, for instance, no one believes that gay men are just exactly like heterosexual couples, except the same gender. No one believes that the gay male dating culture is the way it is because it's stigmatized. People just don't talk. I mean, they do tolerate this because they have to, but people don't believe the bullshit. And as such, a lot of people who try to run these kind of games kind of get exposed as being very, very low class people. For instance, I mean, the status attached to being trans for the last 5 years in progressive areas has been very high. In the last year, it's cratered. It's gone from being considered a very, very oppressed ethnic group, which in progressive context means it has a lot high status, to being kind of a problem, a social irritant, something that has to be dealt with. People don't relish doing the whole pronoun game anymore. This makes the people who play the game look weak. It makes them look like they're out of touch. And subsequently, it makes the whole circle around it look less preferable. So what are you losing? Why are progressive beliefs costly? A, if you're speaking in the progressive language, you basically have to ignore the reality right in front of your eyes, and you can't talk about the real issues that are going on in front of you. B, performing it is expensive because you expose yourself to a variety of dangers while at the same time not getting your status elevated through the normal means because there are no more elite positions. And C, a lot of this is, I keep on going on digressions, but that's just how I talk. When we think about the HICLIB, do you have these things in Europe? I've only heard about...
Yes.
Sure, I'm sure there's equivalent. I can't think... This seems like a very American phenomenon. I'm sure you have the equivalent in Europe. But these are the people who, they come from a historical demographic that is traditionally conservative or backwards. And maybe there's Irish HICLIBs, but there's a lot of Irish HICLIBs. Grant Linehan might be one, but I think he's having a redemption arc. they come from like these backward, these societies that are considered backwards and conservative. They hit the progressive culture and they immediately become super progressive. And they do so by constantly complaining about specifically conservatives. Now, the problem with this is the HICLIB is the perfect example. In the 90s, that was enough because making enemies of conservative America was lucrative. You wanted them to be enemies because the progressive coalition took care of its own. There were more opportunities there, and conservatives never really defended themselves. They didn't punish enemies. They didn't reward friends. So you joined a side that rewarded friends, and you made the enemies of a side that didn't punish enemies. This game, and I really feel bad for the HICLIBs, it's like they bought into a stock right before the rug got pulled, because the rug is getting pulled out of the HICLIB market in a big way. And this is just the beginning for the HICLIB rug pull, because I guarantee the progressive coalition is not rewarding its white friends anymore. It's done with that. It knows that white progressivism is done the way that we do. The future of the progressive coalition is to funnel money and privileges to the new immigrants that are coming in that really want to take a piece out of the West and make it their own, to be the new colonists of Europe. That is the future of the progressive coalition, both in America and in the West, and then also the progressive managerial types that want to support that. And already established. The progressive coalition does not want to hand more power out to these white guys of middling talent that make a lot of enemies on the right. Conversely, the right wingers, the new right, is starting to think collectively. And if human history is any judge, and this is not a threat, but the number one thing that humans remember when they start thinking collectively aren't ethnic enemies. No one's going to remember what group did to you what when. You know, you have too many enemies to remember any one particular. The people who you really remember are the traitors. And, you know, so the costliness of the belief is going to be you're not going to get any opportunities on the progressive side, and you're going to lose opportunities for a lot of the inside, you know, maybe, you know, again, this might not be true. Maybe, and I hope this isn't the case, maybe a lot of these nationalist and collective modes of thought are going to just be stillbirthed, and they're never going to go anywhere. And we're going to go back to the new right wing is just going to be, it's going to be progressive. The progressive coalition is going to be third world colonists versus the right wing coalition, which is going to be right wing managerial types like Vivek Ramaswamy. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think that the right wing is going to create a new power coalition that's going to, I mean, it might not be this time, but at some point in the future, the right wing is going to create a coalition that is going to play for an enemy politics, in which case these people who display progressive beliefs are losing everything and they're gaining nothing except the possibility of aping a mode of life that at one point in the past was something that was high status.
Yeah, yeah. You can imagine them being like someone in the 90s who was a hippie.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
going for that aesthetic. And it's kind of quirky, but it's not cool. It's not, it's kind of pitiable.
Yeah, and, fortunately or unfortunately, no women are going to remain. Once the tide starts turning, and I don't know when that will be, maybe it will, you know, again, maybe our efforts will be entirely dead in the water. But it's very hard to imagine a West in which the coalition groups are basically third worldists versus managerialists. It's very hard for me to imagine that coalition ruling. It's so hollow and so vulnerable, and I don't know,
it's
dysfunctional, right? It kind of relies on having it seems like it would have to kind of rely on these two very, very tenuous strands to stay up and not, I mean, for instance, like the third worldist coalition is unstable because the third worldist coalition is not a coalition. It's a bunch of people that are brought together by one and only one thing, and that is the fact that they don't like white Christian male people. That's it. And once that piece is no longer an object of hate for them, once there's no other person on that side, once their primary competition becomes somebody else who's not clearly in that category, that coalition will fall apart.
Yeah, because they all hate each other. They're far more racist than you and me. It's far more visceral. So I guess the question is, what becomes of? You've talked about the HicLib, and this is what I was getting to earlier. What is going to be the place for the middle class, blue haired, 20-year-old woman, girl, whatever? On the left. And I think, and you've said that, well, that they'll be elevated, they'll get social status on the left.
They'll try. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I think that, and you know, yeah, there, as I said, there'll be a welcome for them from all the non-white guys. But I just don't think it's going to be sustainable. And so that means, well, what are they? What's going to become of them? Are they just going to be apolitical and sort of silent? Or are they going to join the right, like the ethno-nationalist right?
Well, this is the problem. A lot of them will try to defect. I mean, they'll be incredibly unreliable because they'll do what, you know, a lot of these women have just kind of always gone with the flow. And after a certain age, they'll realize that they'll get, if they switch sides, they'll get a lot of clout, right? Because everyone always loves an apostate from the other side. It weakens them. It makes you look stronger. But the thing is that trick only works once. Once you become a person who regularly apostatizes, this, no one cares or wants to talk about you in any way. And so I don't know. I mean, I think that the left will try to hang on to it, white women, or young white women, or radical white women of all varieties, for as long as humanly possible. It will start to lose its capacity to pay them. And when it loses its capacity to pay them, a lot of them will defect. I don't know what the right can really do with them. It can, you know, and a lot of them will defect again back to the left. And, you know, so that it won't be a very reliable coalition. All I can say, though, is that if the right were ever to win outright, there would be, all of these people would defect to the right side. This is the famous Zero HP Lovecraft. You know that he had this quote. He said he walked into a room with a bunch of women clucking about how they were reading Ibram X. Kendi and Ta-Nehisi Coates, and they were anti-racist. And he thought to himself, he's like, I am listening to these women talk, but every atom of my body knows that the second we won, these women would all be proclaiming that they had always been Nazis. But they'd always been racists. They were always secretly racists. And, you know, these people, they go with the flow, right? And, you know, that also makes them very unreliable as people inside of a coalition.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the real curse of our age. I mean, you know, the real problem we're having right now, Woz, is that all of the pieces, like the game is up. At this stage, the establishment, the left, the university has in its publication said that we were right about most of the big issues that we were arguing about over the last 5 years, over the trans issue, over the COVID origin issue, over the discrimination against white men issue, over mass immigration even, and its impact on GDP. And its ability to be integrated in a society that's cohesive. They've admitted to all of this. And the problem is the fact that the population, that there's not enough energized and organized young men to take effective political action. And, you know, because the millennials, which is, you know, the Gen Xers and millennials are about as young as you possibly could be and act on this. The boomers aren't going to do anything. Their time is up. They only have one more decision, and that's who they're going to essentially bequeath their legacy to, which is kind of radically being eroded as we speak. But the problem is that the Xers and the millennials, they're a much smaller cohort than their parents are. And furthermore, you know, the power inside the millennial cohort is heavily skewed towards the female half. And the female half is not going to want, the female half will follow a political movement that looks like it's winning. It will never spearhead a political movement. I don't think there's ever been an instance where a female political coalition has spearheaded a radical political movement. They always follow it.
Yeah. And this creates a picture where, okay, the boomers are gone, and, you know, I don't hate them. I criticize them and we have a laugh and all that. But, you know, some of my best relatives are boomers. So I don't look forward to this. But especially politically, you know, it's going to be very different once they go, because it's kind of like, we've been playing on easy mode in a way for all this time, because ultimately whites have always been the majority throughout all the bullshit that we've seen, all the Pakistani rape gangs. All of that happened in a context where white people were the undisputed majority. With the next, once the boomers go, that's going to be a lot more blurred.
Yeah.
And I think you know, shit's going to get real in a way, because the stakes are going to be so much more obvious once the boomers have gone, just because of the demographics. That
the demographics will shift radically in a lot of these countries, which will be very scary. You know, I mean, the one possibility, and the one real white pill is that if right-wingers, if the coalition of various right-wing movements, again, there's not one right-wing, this is not like the left, but if the various groups inside our countries can, when that transition comes, come out of the gates storming as the most organized, the most connected to reality group, the most cohesive group, they have the chance of kind of seizing the reins at a critical moment and kind of turning things around all at once. Sure, the boomers are going to leave, and they're going to leave a country behind where in maybe a lot of cases, if not most, their descendants will be minorities inside their own communities. But a lot, those new communities will also be disorganized. There's not going to be another community that has a clear, decisive share of the population that is nearly the size of the right-wing coalition. And so, and I think that when the boomers go, the left, as we know it, will permanently collapse. I mean, it already pretty much died this year, but the remnants of it will kind of fade into history with the boomers, because there will be no more support coming from that cohort.
Yeah. It's a fascinating thing to think about, and it's going to be grim for a while, but I don't see this as a pessimistic thing. You know, I'm not saying this to depress anyone. I think this is actually going to clarify everything. It's going to be really a much simpler situation, because there won't be that the demographics will be much starker, and there won't be the need to bullshit to placate the boomers anymore.
Yeah, the question is, where does their money go? And this is something that's sort of been a consistent. I don't think we should really worry about the money, because I think that there will be a realignment. And you know, when Trump came, you know, he didn't have any money. Now he has got tons of donors, right? This is, money will follow power, because it's way easier to get money if you have power than it is to buy power when you have money. So you know, but you know, we do have to be focused on this idea. Okay, like, pretend that you were in a place that looked like London, that looked like California, that looked like any place that has really bad demographics in the West. How would you start thinking about your priorities politically? How would you start organizing? Because organizing is the name of the game. That is what people need to be doing. There is a variety of organizations that do this, but this is the name of the game in terms of winning, in terms of securing a future for our children, for our peoples more broadly, and to not be the scapegoats of history. I mean, I don't know. I you know, do you want, I mean, I don't want my son to face what Jacob Savage described in that article in Compact. That is absolutely nuts. That is, the government will ensure that your child's dreams do not happen. Okay,
yeah, so you know, it's not the society you want to live in. That's insane.
No, and look, you know, maybe we will live in societies that are much poorer, but I don't know. Living in a society where the people around you are working towards the future of your children rather than against them, I don't know. The former is just so unsustainable, and it is the most depressing thing about living in the modern world. I don't know if the departure of the boomers is going to change this woes, because I'm too pessimistic to guarantee that. But, you know, I this can't go on where the people who are occupying all of the institutions that are demanding we're loyal to them broadcast the fact that their main goal is to dispossess our children of
yes.
of the stuff that we worked for. And then to feed us platitudes about citizenship tests and GDP lines and abstract principles that wouldn't even be recognized by the people who wrote those abstract principles on paper. That it's such a spiritual wound to have to deal with this bullshit. And I don't know. I mean, my hope is that when this gets going, when, you know, for instance, and we've done a lot of organization, at least in this country, at least in my own little group, my own little corner of the right wing. Once you get a critical mass of people who you can trust that are nearby you, the calculus begins to shift radically. And there's still a lot of hurdles that have to be overcome. The right wing's main problem has always been one of quality control. And we still struggle with that. But, you know, the fact that you're seeing these things, kind of these green shoots, you know, at least in some areas, spring up, it is encouraging that there is kind of life after dispossession. I mean, I think, you know, the most inspiring person I oftentimes look to has been Conscious Caracol. I can never remember if his real name is out there, so I just won't say it. But you know, he works with Afroforum in South Africa. I mean, Orania, I've never been there. I've had friends who have, but every time I see it, I'm like, that looks like a very optimistic place. And it's in a dire situation, but just having the people who you work around be on your side is something that it is a source of power that is kind of incalculable. Did I lose you?
Yeah. Yes, it is. I was posting something in the live chat.
No problem.
I don't think whites are going to get dispossessed. Certainly not in the European countries. I just don't think it's going to happen because I just don't think they're going to put up with it.
The thing with the European countries is their claim is so strong that, you know, it does feel like you're also catching this earlier too.
Yeah. And the demographics, rat race. Yeah, we are. But I don't think it will happen in America either. I mean, the worst case scenario for America is gated cities or balkanization where states, and Mark Weber doesn't think this is going to happen. But one way or another, people creating gated areas, their own areas. That's the worst case scenario for white America, I think. I don't think they're going to get race mixed out of existence. There might well be roving bands of men looking for white people to kill, but again, that's what gated cities are for. That I think is the worst case scenario for America. Britain, we're more compressed, so that's a danger. Mm. But I mean, it's not going to be plain sailing. But
I don't think roving bands can happen in America. That happened in South Africa because there's one majority group there. Basically, what will happen in America is that everyone is going to turtle up in their own little places, and the federal government will tolerate that as long as the tax money flows. You know,
and I think that in Europe, it won't be plain sailing, but I just don't think people are going to submit to extinction. Or a scenario that will lead to that. Again, it always comes back to luxury.
Well, once I mean, yeah, there's this.
What's going to happen? People are going to fight back against it.
I don't think any group is going to go extinct simply from the heat by evaporation thing. you know, eventually you get to some subset of people who are dedicated to survival, and then that subset survives. The question is how big that percentage is. And, you know, sometimes that percentage isn't big enough to carry on an identity in its own right, and it gets absorbed into a similar related identity. And that definitely probably will happen to some groups in America. I just say things like Piers Morgan and the whole, you know, I'd sell my people for curry thing. I understand. I've heard that before, but every time you hear it, you kind of just, your jaw just drops open at the level of disconnection we have with that generation. I don't know. Yeah. Some people are resigned to extinction. They are just that deluded. They think that some magic property has been transmitted to people who are obviously not being assimilated into the host culture. And because of that,
I wouldn't take seriously what Piers Morgan said. I think he was trolling. I think he was taking the piss out of nationalists. I don't believe for a second that he would actually endure any suffering whatsoever. I think he's a fat, pampered fucking lump of a man who has been able to not take anything seriously for his entire life. And it's impossible for him to believe that young people today aren't in that same position that he's been in all his life.
Yeah, it is difficult because, I mean, he certainly voted that. I mean, you see this, the same thing is true for like Bill Maher, right? It's just, these boomers, they say things, and I don't even know what they mean. I guess it's like, what did Wittgenstein say? If a lion could speak, we wouldn't understand what he meant. And you're right. I do recognize that Piers Morgan was trolling. Possibly Bill Maher was trolling when he was trying to take credit for the de-Englishification of Britain, or, you know, the demographic replacement of the English.
I think that's different. I don't think he was trolling.
Well, but okay, but what do they, I don't know. That seems just as insane to me as what Piers Morgan said. And the question is, what do they actually believe? And I have no idea. I have no idea what they actually believe.
Yeah, and this is a very common problem. I mean, what does ContraPoint really believe?
Oh.
What do so many people actually really believe? Because you and I think, are quite careful in what we see, and we're careful in forming our beliefs. Most people aren't. And Piers Morgan, I think he just says whatever he needs to say to advance his career and to incite people's anger, because that gets him clicks. But Bill Maher, I think, was sincere for reasons that we don't need to go into.
That cook guy, the Italian guy killed himself, I think. I can't remember his name, but he was talking about demographic replacement too. These people live lives that just, they repeat this stuff and they don't really even understand what it means. They're not they haven't interfaced with reality for so long. They have no idea what that looks like.
Yeah, well, that exactly. And I think that Piers Morgan just isn't taking this whole thing seriously. He was joking around. I can't remember what he said. I think his comment was, I think someone said he'd sacrifice his people for a curry. And he replied, "I do love a good curry," something like that. Yeah. He was just winding the guy up, and people, and I'm not saying that's any less contemptible, by the way. I'm just saying, I don't think he takes any of this seriously. He's not thinking about it. And he's not thinking about it because it's not socially safe to think about it, as you said at the start. If he knows that if he were to actually think about this, he might come to a conclusion that would damage his career.
Yeah. And this is, I think, this is true with most things. The left does not think about politics in the serious way that the right does. It thinks about politics as sort of an entertainment product at this stage of its development. And so it's very difficult to, I mean, that this is why discourse is sort of impossible with them. And it we have to deal with it. We have to figure out a way to get on the right side of its collapse. But, navigating that is going to be difficult, I think.
Yeah, it will. Well, one other scenario I wanted to put to you. Mm-hmm. This is something that occurred to me recently. Because after I wrote The Left is Dead and The Wages of Wokery, which were two essays kind of about the same thing, but approaching it from very different angles. But after I wrote that, Charlie Kirk got killed. And so I thought, okay, so the left has given up on debate, but they haven't given up on winning. They'll just kill people. They'll resort to the tactics for which they were once well known a long time ago. But another possibility is Trump doesn't win, or Vance doesn't win in,
28. Yeah.
Yeah. That's only 2 years away. Yep. Well, three years away.
About three.
Yeah. So if they don't win and the Democrats get back in, the scenario is that the left is re-energized and loads more money pumps back into the left, and suddenly it becomes socially advantageous and cool to be, you know, what the people we've been fighting and arguing with for the last 10 years.
Loads more money pumps into the left. I do not know if enthusiasm pumps back into the left. I don't know. Do you remember 2021?
Yes, unfortunately,
a down year for the right, in the fact that it felt like we were all going to get rounded up by either the social media censorship team or literally like security agencies, right? That's what it felt like in 2021. And, but I'll say this, as someone who watches the left was not re-energized in 2021. In fact, it felt like all the air was going out of their sails. 2020 was the high point of leftist enthusiasm. After they won, they immediately lost momentum. And it was because the establishment couldn't pay back its constituencies in the same way that it once did, because the machine of the apparatus of the cathedral was in many ways critically broken. The left could sail back into power in 2028. Their ability to inspire enthusiasm among ground soldiers that would create a resurgence that feels organic is probably very limited. They will absolutely try to arrest the Trump administration. They absolutely will try to seize assets. But this is a prediction, in my estimation, that they'll only be able to do that in a very, very ham-fisted way, in a very, very overt way. Their ability to manufacture an organic, native counter-reaction is going to be very, very limited, because I don't think they have the money to afford what it would require to build that at that stage. What they're doing, what the left does, they get money. Okay, look, we're coming up on time, but, this is, I'll put it to you this way. In the 1970s, the left-wing apparatus had a ton of money because there was not a huge debt. I mean, there was the national debt, but it wasn't enormous. It was, it was low by historical GDP standards. And it got a huge amount of wealth from the fact that it owned the universities. It took this money and essentially gave it to a bunch of, how do I put this gently, true believers who were native in stock. Well, first of all, they were true believers. They were upper middle class, as we might say in America, or they were middle class people or lower middle class people who had found their way into the upper middle class. And the only thing they wanted to do was advance the cause. Since the 2000s, the left has been taking potentially an even larger amount of money, and it's been paying its constituents out. But do you know where this money flows? It goes into people who are just like, oh, I want to go on like a cruise. I want to buy, like BLM is a great example of this. BLM got billions of dollars. You know where it all went? They bought houses for all their relatives, right?
Oh, yeah. Buy large mansions.
Buy large mansions was the joke, right? The Somalia community, the leftist apparatus inside Minneapolis and inside Minnesota has been funneling billions into the Somalian community, billions. And well, they should, because the Samoan community votes left like you wouldn't believe it, right? They're okay, but where does it go? Do they buy like they did when $1 billion goes into the Somalian community? Is it the same way as like when $1 billion went into the Berkeley activists in the 1970s? Well, sure, yeah, the Somalians take it and then they ship it all back home. And it goes into like what, Al-Shabaab or whatever, right? Or it goes into like car dealerships for, or like hotel chains or something like that, right? It doesn't get recirculated ideologically. It just gets consumed. So the leftist funding apparatus has been gummed up by its own coalitions shattering. The people who are now accepting checks as activists don't want to win a cause. They just want to cash out and feed more money to their own groups, or they just want to retire and kick it.
Right. Okay. So there's less of a sense of purpose than
exactly right
than there was. Yeah.
And this is the real, like, the, you know, the asabiya, right? The I mean, you know, no direct translation from Arabic, but roughly it's like stick togetherness or focus on the collective purpose. You know, this is something that the left lost. This is why it died, right? This is what they have. They, and I don't think if they come back in 2028, they'll throw a lot of people in jail. They'll censor a lot of social media accounts as much as they can. It'll be way worse than 2021. But they will not get back that enthusiasm because all the checks they cash are going to go straight into the safety deposit boxes of their constituent groups. And they'll never see that money back in terms of actual belief.
Right. Okay. One of the things you said, we'll get to the super chats in a moment, but I'll ask you one last question.
Where is the live chat, by the way? Sorry.
It's in Rumble and Odyssey. Rumble,
okay. Okay. I'll look for it in Rumble.
One of the things you said in your live stream after Charlie Kirk's killing was that, and maybe I'm misremembering. I'm pretty sure it was you. You said that the right, the government should now dismantle the left, and that should include revamping or even abolishing the American university system as we know it.
It should. It's a tough nut to crack, certainly.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, though, because for many reasons, economic and technological, I do think that university is kind of a farce at this point. Yeah. I don't really know why people need to go to university anymore. And I'm not saying that because I begrudge them it. I mean, but it's just, it's a waste of time and money.
No, and I have a graduate degree. No. I have a PhD. And I agree, like, especially since the AI cheating is so rampant these days, right? And no one's enforcing it. And, you know, and there's no useful skills that come out of it anyway. Well, where was I?
Is it obsolete? Is it something that a responsible government would actually just defund and dismantle at this point?
The problem is, I mean, I would want to. That is, you can't change the regime without changing the universities. There is just no way. As long as the elite is trained by the university system, And I think actually, now that you mentioned that, I think it's probably something that Aaron McIntyre said, because I agree that's what we should do. But I am aware of just the monstrosity of that task. It is the current elite sees the university system as a cash cow for the country, which it is. It is also a security liability because it's a way that other countries get to share in our tech. And, you know, and it is a huge liability for the native population because it fuels middle class debt. So if there is a way to radically reorganize the universities by taking their research apparatus and nationalizing them into something like what we have in Lawrence Livermore National Labs or something like that, you know, or Los Alamos, those kind of arrangements where it's like under direct military oversight, and then use the rest of the educational facility for something entirely different. That would be the way that I would do that. That would require total control over the American government, because once the university is attacked, alarm bells will go off all across the system. The entire elite is invested in having the university maintain itself as an institution of prestige. You know, I mean, Princeton is a great example. This is probably the best, you know, people quibble, it's probably like the best research institution, the best elite finishing school the country has, people like Harvard or Yale, whatever. I'm not quibbling here, right? The leaders it graduates goes from, you know, something like Woodrow Wilson, who might have been an evil man, but was certainly very educated, to someone like Sonia Sotomayor, who's just a moron, right? Like, just an absolute moron. And she's not alone, right? There's a whole group of people like this that, and it's only gotten worse. And, you know, the question is, okay, so why don't we just get rid of Princeton or totally reorganize it? Well, you can't, because all of the people who are currently the boomers and the Xers, who are the most intelligent people of their generation, if Princeton suddenly does not, if the name does not command respect, then in many ways they feel like their life's legacy has been tarnished. And so when you make that move, you earn a lot of enemies.
Yeah, and understandably. I mean, you can just imagine the reaction if Trump did this.
Yeah.
It would confirm the left's worst stereotypes off him as a complete ignoramus and boor.
And he can't understand anything higher than money. Donors. Every donor who is an alumni of that college would be calling him, withdrawing funds. It would be personal for them, right? If people went to Ivy League, I mean, that's what Ivy League really does. It really inducts in you this idea that, like, you're a made, like, when you go to Yale, you're a made man. They have names for themselves. They call themselves, like, Yaleys, right? Like, oh, I didn't know he was a Yaley. Like, what? You know, like, they have clubs and the stuff. Like, you know, I lived in one of these towns. I didn't go to one of these schools, but I lived in the town. And the way they have of talking to each other, it's a preservation from the old world. And it actually, if we could replicate that inside right-wing institutions, that would be a major achievement. That kind of camaraderie, that kind of feeling of graduation into an elect, that would be amazing. But that is the only thing like that that exists. And those guys, those 40, 50, 60-year-old millionaires and billionaires, they're all holding degrees. Jeff Bezos holds a degree from Princeton, you know. And I know he's one of our enemies, but I guarantee you that there's five donors just like Jeff Bezos on the Republican side. That, like, Princeton gets nationalized or the prestige goes down and, you know, you have a rebellion of your coalition on your hands. I think parallelism in this way, I hate to say it because it's so slow. And, you know, but there needs to be a degree of parallelism that goes on from this point forward. And, you know, maybe we can do that, you know, in combination with the universities because... But I don't know, like, the Turning Point USA project of creating, like, conservative groups inside the university system has been an abject failure. I mean, Turning Point as a symbol is immortal because of Charlie Kirk. But their mission of creating little bubbles of conservative resistance inside leftist universities has been a failure, not least of which because of... Well, you know what Jacob Savage described in his article, right? You're having all of the demographics like constrained, like throttled by that effort. And you're sitting there going like, well, maybe if we can scoop up 50% of this one demographic that's being throttled. No, like, and you know, and you're playing by your enemy's rules while you're there as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a sense that, well, with Charlie Kirk, I think it was always this peaceful approach, and I think towards the end he was realizing that it was really heating up. But yeah. I take the point that you can't really, you know, practically speaking, you can't dismantle it without pissing off a lot of people. I think you're right. It must have been Orrin McIntyre who said this, that we need to dismantle that system.
Orrin McIntyre is much more cavalier because he's not aware of what it would be like to storm a castle like this. It would be very messy. I mean, he is probably, but, you know, I have a little bit more experience in university towns.
Right. Yeah. Well, one other thing related to this is one of my guests on this millennial, I can't remember which one, said that the university environment in America, yes, it was Elizabeth Heverin, and she was talking about 2022, 21. She went on a, she had some sort of educational, what's the word? She was at an American university for a period of time. No, like a sabbatical.
Sabbaticals.
Yeah, I think that's the term. And she was there for a while, and she said that the, and bear in mind that that's 4 years ago now, so maybe things have changed, but what she said was that the environment there was even more left-wing than on a British university.
Yeah, campus. I think that's maintained. Well, I mean, what I notice is not necessarily that it's more left-wing. It might be less left-wing. But what I immediately notice is the quality of the student kind of precipitously degrading. That's what I notice mostly about modern university students. Not that they're more leftist, but they're just like, I don't want to say lower IQ, but kind of, I guess.
Yes.
And
yeah, I mean, you can hear it.
Yeah, especially in a place like Princeton, which is a place that I, for the longest time, thought was just like beyond my grasp. And I come from a pretty academic background. And whenever somebody came from Princeton and I talked to them, it felt like, again, talking to an aristocrat. And then you go around the campus and you're just thinking, what is going on? These feel like, you know, this doesn't feel like what it would be to be in Princeton or talk to a Princeton student, right? You know, and again, I didn't go to school there. I'm just talking about, I'm a townie walking through the campus and hearing conversations and occasionally engaging with people there who are students, you know.
I think that's the same here. I mean, if you were to go to Cambridge or Oxford, you wouldn't find, you know, you wouldn't find Evelyn Waugh there. You wouldn't find C.S. Lewis. It wouldn't be, but also just their manners, their diction, their way of presenting themselves. All of that has gone downhill. That might just be general cultural degradation. But I also think in the case of these universities, it's the diversity hiring inevitably.
I mean, look, it was hard to say before that Jacob Savage article and all of the, I don't want to shortchange people like Jeremy Carl, who also wrote about this. you know, I always hate that when people break something and, you know, other people broke it better before. And then the one that goes viral, incidentally, is the one that gets remembered. But, you know, I think it's pretty clear that that played a larger role than we had previously thought, for sure.
Yeah. Well, my question was about if the university system is this left-wing, and Elizabeth was talking about three or four years ago, then if it's still like that, then what is the future for those students? Are they just going to have to align with a more, like once they get out of university, are they going to find the environment that you sketched earlier where there just isn't a career or social cachet in being left-wing? So then the beliefs that they soaked up at university in this, you know, commie factory are just going to have to be discarded immediately.
Well, this is one thing we have to really distinguish ourselves between the university system generally and a place like Princeton. The people who are in Princeton have it made. You know, I don't care. The ruling class will make sure that they're hired. Their own, if they belong to another community, a minority community, that community will elevate them because of their connections. If they are of a heritage persuasion, then the old fogies who are millionaires will preferentially hire them. I'm not worried about people from Princeton or Yale. it's the lower colleges that will really get it. And in many ways, the lower colleges got the leftism more. One thing I immediately realized too, looking at kind of lower tier colleges and comparing them to places that are like Ivy League, the trans stuff did not hit the Ivy League very much at all. Not very much at all. It's, you know, maybe Berkeley might be one of the instances where it's still an elite college and this phenomenon really hit hard. But I see most of this stuff, especially with the gender stuff in the last 5 years, that really hit the more lower colleges in America. And that's where the problems are going to start emerging. These people are not going to be able to hook into the lives that they had tried to craft for themselves when they were in college. And they'll look around for other opportunities politically and economically. And I don't know.
That some actually, of them ironically, they'll be in the position that white millennial men were in 10, 12 years ago when they'd been trained for something and then they found that it just wasn't there once they graduated.
I mean, that cohort's only going to grow over time, which is really what's so scary. And look, I don't think they're all going to find the right wing, but they're going to find people who are playing power politics in a much more real way. And then we're going to end up with a real political crisis in the West. And I don't know how it's going to resolve itself.
Yeah. Lots of unemployed, unemployable, blue-haired nutters. Okay. So we'll get to the super chats now. Mm-hmm. Ghost Dog Man gave $5. Thank you very much. Flair Cake said, "Woes, I'm having a devil of a time leaving super chats this millennial. I hope this gets to you. Also, thanks for having Dave on again. The guy's hilarious." Well, I'm glad you find him hilarious. Also edifying and enlightening.
It's just my California accent, nasally accent.
Well, the super chats, I realized that the Telegram bot isn't working. I believe it isn't. So sorry about that, everyone. It's too late now to fix it, but I'll do what I can. I had a go last night and didn't get anywhere. It's very involved. So my apologies about that. But Ko-fi, GoFundMe, the Rumble Rants, and of course Entropy should all be working fine. Okay, Bindle made a very generous super chat. Thank you. And he said, "I first learned of Dave by watching his 2018 appearance on Millennial. Been enjoying his content ever since. And I even joined a local Old Glory Club chapter because of him."
That's great. Yeah.
And he says, "Thank you, Woes, for consistently hosting so many people from various corners of the online right. I wouldn't be where I am organizing locally without that. Merry Christmas." Well, that's great. I'm really pleased to have helped bring you to where you are now and to have been of help to you. Thank you.
The OGC has been doing really great work, you know, and it's American only, but I really hope that other countries can develop their own networks like it.
Like the Old Glory Club.
Yeah. And I know, like I spent half my time in Canada. I understand that a lot of that stuff just isn't possible in countries that have paranoid policies like Canada. And so it's no fault of their own that we can't organize like that. But, you know, I think that with time, these opportunities will present themselves.
Yeah, so do I. For all the reasons that we've gone into here. Sam said, "Great discussion with Dave. Merry Christmas." Thank you very much. Dardy, "Fantastic conversation. Always enjoy hearing the distributist on Millennial. Please tell me Dave has retired the interviewing leftists and bread tubers series. Some of those were a chore to get through. Wishing you both a very Merry Christmas." Well, I enjoyed them. I just couldn't understand how you could stand it, Dave.
Yeah.
Stamina was incredible.
I kind of have partially retired. I told myself after Charlie Kirk died, and I just started blocking leftists left and right, and because I was just so tired, I couldn't put up with it anymore when they were just lying about Charlie Kirk and about the kind of person he was to get on the right. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I did get lured into one debate on a moderate channel called PF Young, who's kind of like this Jordan Peterson type, let's all have a conversation type character, kind of kind of stuck in a time warp from 2017, but you know, a good guy. I don't know what's the point. I mean, it's kind of fun to debate leftists because you get a sense of how their mind works, but a lot of times what they're just destiny clones, which is not very fun, right?
Oh God.
Destiny.
I'm allergic to that.
Yeah. He's just playing a game. It's like, you know, you could program an AI to do that. You know, it's a game. It's not an actual dialectic.
Yeah. And I would say the same about Piers Morgan. That's what I meant about Piers. He's just saying whatever he has to say to get the reaction and look victorious. Yeah, Destiny, I could never interact with him because he would drive me mad. Because precisely for this reason, I don't believe that he really believes anything at all.
It's obvious he doesn't too. It's all of these people like Richard Hanania, Noah Smith, and Matt Iglesias, all of these managerial, types. They say one thing one day, another thing another day. There's no attempt to actually honestly come to some kind of conclusion about the world and the state of the world that we live in. And it is, I don't know. There's no real point. And I honestly don't understand how they're so popular. With Destiny, I had to believe it was some kind of algorithmic manipulation in 2019, but I don't know. I can't imagine what people get out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just find it very ugly. It's just like peering into nihilism. All right. Ghost Dog Man. Is the author Cormac McCarthy just an anti-white doom pornographer, or am I missing something? I have Blood Meridian on the shelf, but after watching No Country for Old Men, I find him sus.
Well, he certainly toys with nihilism a lot. This came out after your conversation with him, but the Endeavor, he released a magnificent essay that used Cormac McCarthy's The Road as imagistic source material. And Endeavor said, I found The Road is this horrifically depressing novel about a father and son surviving this post-apocalyptic reality that seems to have no hope. And Endeavor said that he found it uplifting because there is just something incredibly noble about fighting for survival when there seemed to be absolutely no hope. And there was this uplifting quality that what was being pursued was genuinely heroic. And I think that there's elements of that in all McCarthy's books. They all deal with nihilism and the silence of God and the absence of meaning. McCarthy certainly is not reveling in it. And in many cases, it could be said that he's using it as a springboard to underline a very human and non-nihilistic larger message.
All right. Sounds like you need to do a bigger video about that.
I recently read Blood Meridian again, so I was well read for that.
Okay. Well, then the final one is from The Wanderer. What is your view of monetary reform? A century ago, Chesterton and C.H. Douglas types were espousing 3 acres and a cow or social credit. It's clear our data, this is about monetary reform, it's clear our data is valuable, but I'm pessimistic of how one acquires this via blockchain.
Well, look, the source of a lot of the modern problems in the West have to do with this inflationary monetary policy that we've been pursuing for the last 100 years, I guess, roundabout. And I think that this whole thing needs to be kind of reset. I think that this is a separate question from how you deal with equitable distribution inside a country, especially when there's so much automation everywhere. And, managing that, I think those things have to be managed in sort of two parts. And, I don't know. It's like, we've got a serial killer cutting apart someone with a chainsaw, and the person that they're about to cut apart, essentially has an appendix that's about to explode. Like, they need surgery. Like, we have to stop the person with the chainsaw from cutting them in half before we do this very delicate operation of monetary reform. This monetary reform it's a system that's not designed to be dismantled, and no one's ever dismantled something like it, like the banking system that we have currently. And so it would have to be done very, very, very carefully, and with somebody who had a unified vision about what would come afterwards, which we currently don't have and can't have inside a country that has such a destabilized political order.
Well, and that gets onto a huge question of what is going to become of all this. Are we seeing now the end of an epoch where you just can't continue with this system, the governmental system, the economic system, the educational system, and all the cultural systems, because they've reached a natural end point, if not because of their own internal narratives, then because of the demographics. It's just not sustainable anymore. So,
I mean, yeah, the ruling class. The ruling class, they're betting everything that some amount of automation is going to fix this problem. I doubt that's the case. But we'll say,
Yeah. All right. Well, as I said at the start, we are at a transitional moment. And I think that Dave and I have ably demonstrated that with our lack of conclusiveness throughout this stream. It's certainly been an interesting discussion. And it's exactly what I was hoping for.
Perfect. Always glad to come on, Wills.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I hope everyone else has enjoyed listening to this. It's a shame about Paul Weston tonight. Maybe we can reschedule him for some other time or at least some later year. In the meantime, I will be back tomorrow night with the final night of interviews, and that is with Frodi Midyard, then Dogmatic Slumbers, then Ramsey Paul, and then Soaker City. So, should be good. Hopefully it will all go to plan. I don't think there'll be any more cancellations. It seems unlikely. All right. I'll see you all then. In the meantime, Dave, the distributist, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.